Penguin Audio presents Cujo by Stephen King. Read by Lorna Raver. This book is for my brother David, who held my hand crossing West Broad Street and who taught me how to make sky hooks out of old coat hangers. The trick was so damned good, I just never stopped. I love you, David. About suffering, they were never wrong, the old masters. How well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. W.H. Auden, Musée des Beaux-Arts. Old Blue died, and he died so hard he shook the ground in my backyard. I dug his grave with a silver spade, and I lowered him down with a golden chain. Every link, you know, I did call his name. I called, "Here, Blue, you good dog, you." Folk song. Nope, nothing wrong here. The sharp cereal professor. Once upon a time, not so long ago, a monster came to the small town of Castle Rock, Maine. He killed a waitress named Alma Frechette in 1970, a woman named Pauline Toothaker, and a junior high school student named Cheryl Moody in 1971, a pretty girl named Carol Dunbarger in 1974, a teacher named Etta Ringgold in the fall of 1975, finally, a grade schooler named Mary Kate Henderson in the early winter of that same year. He was not werewolf, vampire, ghoul, or unnameable creature from the enchanted forest or from the snowy wastes. He was only a cop named Frank Dodd, with mental and sexual problems. A good man named John Smith uncovered his name by a kind of magic, but before he could be captured, perhaps it was just as well, Frank Dodd killed himself. There was some shock, of course, but mostly there was rejoicing in that small town, rejoicing because the monster which had haunted so many dreams was dead, dead at last. A town's nightmares were buried in Frank Dodd's grave. Yet even in this enlightened age, when so many parents are aware of the psychological damage they may do to their children, surely there was one parent somewhere in Castle Rock, or perhaps one grandmother, who quieted the kids by telling them that Frank Dodd would get them if they didn't watch out, if they weren't good. And surely a hush fell as children looked toward their dark windows and thought of Frank Dodd in his shiny black vinyl raincoat, Frank Dodd, who had choked and choked and choked. "He's out there," I can hear the grandmother whispering as the wind whistles down the chimney pipe and snuffles around the old pot lid crammed in the stove hole. "He's out there, and if you're not good, it may be his face you see looking in your bedroom window after everyone in the house is asleep except you. It may be his smiling face you see peeking at you from the closet in the middle of the night. The stop sign he held up when he crossed the little children in one hand, the razor he used to kill himself in the other. So shh, children, shh." But for most, the ending was the ending. There were nightmares, to be sure, and children who lay wakeful, to be sure, and the empty Dodd house, for his mother had a stroke shortly afterwards and died, quickly gained a reputation as a haunted house and was avoided. But these were passing phenomena, the perhaps unavoidable side effects of a chain of senseless murders. But time passed, 5 years of time. The monster was gone. The monster was dead. Frank Dodd moldered inside his coffin. Except that the monster never dies. Werewolf, vampire, ghoul, unnameable creature from the wastes. The monster never dies. It came to Castle Rock again in the summer of 1980. Tad Trenton, 4 years old, awoke one morning not long after midnight in May of that year, needing to go to the bathroom. He got out of bed and walked half asleep toward the white light thrown in a wedge through the half-open door, already lowering his pajama pants. He urinated forever, flushed, and went back to bed. He pulled the covers up, and that was when he saw the creature in his closet. Low to the ground it was, with huge shoulders bulking above its cocked head, its eyes amber-glowing pits, a thing that might have been half man, half wolf. And its eyes rolled to follow him as he sat up, his scrotum crawling, his hair standing on end, his breath a thin winter whistle in his throat. Mad eyes that laughed, eyes that promised horrible death, and the music of screams that went unheard. Something in the closet. He heard its purring growl. He smelled its sweet carrion breath. Tad Trenton clapped his hands to his eyes, hitched in breath, and screamed. A muttered exclamation in another room, his father. A scared cry of, "What was that?" from the same room, his mother. Their footfalls running. As they came in, he peered through his fingers and saw it there in the closet, snarling, promising dreadfully that they might come, but they would surely go, and that when they did. The light went on. Vic and Donna Trenton came to his bed, exchanging a look of concern over his chalky face and his staring eyes, and his mother said, "No," snapped. "I told you 3 hot dogs was too many, Vic." And then his daddy was on the bed, daddy's arm around his back, asking him what was wrong. Tad dared to look into the mouth of his closet again. The monster was gone. Instead of whatever hungry beast he had seen, there were 2 uneven piles of blankets, winter bedclothes, which Donna had not yet gotten around to taking up to the cut-off 3rd floor. These were stacked on the chair which Tad used to stand on when he needed something from the high closet shelf. Instead of the shaggy, triangular head cocked sideways in a kind of predatory, questioning gesture, he saw his teddy bear on the taller of the 2 piles of blankets. Instead of pitted and baleful amber eyes, there were the friendly brown glass balls from which his teddy observed the world. "What's wrong, Tadder?" his daddy asked him again.
"There was a monster," Tad cried, "in my closet."
And he burst into tears. His mommy sat with him. They held him between them, soothed him as best they could. There followed the ritual of parents. They explained there were no monsters, that he had just had a bad dream. His mommy explained how shadows could sometimes look like the bad things they sometimes showed on TV or in the comic books. And Daddy told him everything was all right, fine, that nothing in their good house could hurt him. Tad nodded and agreed that it was so, although he knew it was not. His father explained to him how, in the dark, the 2 uneven piles of blankets had looked like hunched shoulders, how the teddy bear had looked like a cocked head, and how the bathroom light, reflecting from Teddy's glass eyes, had made them seem like the eyes of a real live animal. "Now look," he said. "Watch me close, Tadder." Tad watched. His father took the 2 piles of blankets and put them far back in Tad's closet. Tad could hear the coat hangers jingling softly, talking about Daddy in their coat hanger language. That was funny, and he smiled a little. Mommy caught his smile and smiled back, relieved. His daddy came out of the closet, took Teddy, and put him in Tad's arms. "And last but not least," Daddy said with a flourish and a bow that made both Tad and Mommy giggle, "the chair." He closed the closet door firmly and then put the chair against the door. When he came back to Tad's bed, he was still smiling, but his eyes were serious. "Okay, Tad?"
"Yes," Tad said,
and then forced himself to say it.
But it was there, Daddy. I saw it. Really.
Your mind saw something, Tad, Daddy said, and his big warm hand stroked Tad's hair. But you didn't see a monster in your closet, not a real one. There are no monsters, Tad, only in stories and in your mind.
He looked from his father to his mother and back again, their big, well-loved faces.
Really?
Really, his mommy said. Now, I want you to get up and go pee, big guy.
I did. That's what woke me up.
Well, she said, because parents never believed you. Humor me, then. What do you say? So he went in, and she watched while he did four drops, and she smiled and said, "See, you did have to go." Resigned, Tad nodded, went back to bed, was tucked in, accepted kisses. And as his mother and father went back to the door, the fear settled on him again like a cold coat full of mist, like a shroud stinking of hopeless death.
Oh, please,
he thought, but there was no more. Just that.
Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please.
Perhaps his father caught his thoughts, because Vic turned back, one hand on the light switch, and repeated,
"No monsters, Tad."
No, Daddy,
Tad said, because in that instant his father's eyes seemed shadowed and far, as if he needed to be convinced.
No monsters, except for the one in my closet.
The light snapped off. Good night, Tad, his mother's voice trailed back to him lightly, softly. And in his mind he cried out,
"Be careful, Mummy. They eat the ladies. In all the movies they catch the ladies and carry them off and eat them. Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please."
But they were gone. So Tad Trenton, 4 years old, lay in his bed, all wires and stiff erector-set braces. He lay with the covers pulled up to his chin and one arm crushing Teddy against his chest. And there was Luke Skywalker on one wall. There was a chipmunk standing on a blender on another wall, grinning cheerily. "If life hands you lemons, make lemonade," the cheeky, grinning chipmunk was saying. There was a whole motley Sesame Street crew on a third, Big Bird, Ernie, Oscar, Grover. Good totems, good magic. But oh, the wind outside, screaming over the roof and skating down black gutters. He would sleep no more this night. But little by little, the wires unsnarled themselves, and stiff erector-set muscles relaxed. His mind began to drift. And then a new screaming, this one closer than the night wind outside, brought him back to staring wakefulness again. The hinges on the closet door. That thin sound, so high that perhaps only dogs and small boys awake in the night could have heard it. His closet door swung open slowly and steadily, a dead mouth opening on darkness, inch by inch and foot by foot. The monster was in that darkness. It crouched where it had crouched before. It grinned at him, and its huge shoulders bulked above its cocked head, and its eyes glowed amber, alive with stupid cunning.
"I told you they'd go away, Tad," it whispered. "They always do, in the end. And then I can come back. I like to come back. I like you, Tad. I'll come back every night now, I think, and every night I'll come a little closer to your bed, and a little closer, until one night, before you can scream for them, you'll hear something growling right beside you, Tad. It'll be me, and I'll pounce, and then I'll eat you, and you'll be in me.
Tad stared at the creature in his closet with drugged, horrified fascination. There was something that was almost familiar, something he almost knew. And that was the worst, that almost knowing, because
I'm crazy, Tad. I'm here. I've been here all along. My name was Frank Dodd once, and I killed the ladies, and maybe I ate them, too. I've been here all along. I stick around. I keep my ear to the ground. I'm the monster, Tad. The old monster. And I'll have you soon, Tad. Feel me getting closer and closer.
Perhaps the thing in the closet spoke to him in its own hissing breath, or perhaps its voice was the wind's voice. Either way, neither way, it didn't matter. He listened to its words, drugged with terror, near fainting, but also wide awake. He looked upon its shadowed, snarling face, which he almost knew. He would sleep no more tonight. Perhaps he would never sleep again. But sometime later, sometime between the striking of 1:30 and the 1:00, perhaps because he was small, Tad drifted away again. Thin sleep, in which hulking furred creatures with white teeth chased him, deepened into dreamless slumber. The wind held long conversations with the gutters. A rind of white spring moon rose in the sky. Somewhere far away, in some still meadow of night, or along some pine-edged corridor of forest, a dog barked furiously and then fell silent. And in Tad Trenton's closet, something with amber eyes held watch.
"Did you put the blankets back?"
Donna asked her husband the next morning. She was standing at the stove cooking bacon. Tad was in the other room watching the new zoo review and eating a bowl of Twinkles. Twinkles was a sharp cereal, and the Trentons got all their sharp cereals free. "Hmm?" Vic asked. He was buried deep in the sports pages. A transplanted New Yorker, he had so far successfully resisted Red Sox fever, but he was masochistically pleased to see that the Mets were off to another superlatively cruddy start. The blankets in Todd's closet, they were back in there. The chair was back in there, too, and the door was open again. She brought the bacon, draining on a paper towel and still sizzling, to the table.
"Did you put them back on his chair?"
"Not me," Vic said, turning a page. "It smells like a mothball convention back there."
"That's funny. He must have put them back."
He put the paper aside and looked up at her.
"What are you talking about, Donna?"
"You remember the bad dream last night."
"Not apt to forget. I thought the kid was dying, having a convulsion or something."
She nodded.
"He thought the blankets were some kind of..."
She shrugged.
"Boogeyman," Vic said, grinning.
"I guess so. And you gave him his teddy bear and put those blankets in the back of the closet, but they were back on the chair when I went in to make his bed."
She laughed.
"I looked in, and for just a second there I thought..."
"Now I know where he gets it," Vic said, picking up the newspaper again.
He cocked a friendly eye at her.
"3 hot dogs, my ass."
Later, after Vic had shot off to work, Donna asked Tad why he had put the chair back in the closet with the blankets on it if they had scared him in the night. Tad looked up at her, and his normally animated, lively face seemed pale and watchful, too old. His Star Wars coloring book was open in front of him. He had been doing a picture from the Interstellar Cantina, using his green Crayola to color Greedo.
I didn't, he said. But, Tad, if you didn't, and Daddy didn't, and I didn't...
The monster did it, Tad said. The monster in my closet.
He bent to his picture again. She stood looking at him, troubled, a little frightened. He was a bright boy and perhaps too imaginative.
This was not such good news. She would have to talk to Vic about it tonight. She would have to have a long talk with him about it.
Tad, remember what your father said? She told him now.
There aren't any such things as monsters.
Not in the daytime, anyway, he said,
and smiled at her so openly, so beautifully, that she was charmed out of her fears. She ruffled his hair and kissed his cheek.
She meant to talk to Vic, and then Steve Kemp came while Tad was at nursery school, and she forgot. And Tad screamed that night, too, screamed that it was in his closet, the monster, the monster.
The closet door hung ajar, blankets on the chair. This time Vic took them up to the third floor and stacked them in the closet up there.
Locked it up, Tadder, Vic said, kissing his son. You're all set now. Go back to sleep and have a good dream.
But Tad did not sleep for a long time. And before he did, the closet door swung clear of its latch with a sly little snicking sound, the dead mouth opened on the dead dark where something furry and sharp-toothed and clawed waited, something that smelled of sour blood and dark doom.
"Hello, Tad," it whispered in its rotting voice.
And the moon peered in Tad's window like the white and slitted eye of a dead man. The oldest living person in Castle Rock that late spring was Evelyn Chalmers, known as Aunt Evie by the town's older residents, known as that old loudmouth bitch by George Mira, who had to deliver her mail, which mostly consisted of catalogs and offers from the Reader's Digest and prayer folders from the Crusade of the Eternal Christ, and listen to her endless monologues.
"The only thing that old loudmouth bitch is any good at is telling the weather," George had been known to allow when in his cups and in the company of his cronies down at the Mellow Tiger. It was one stupid name for a bar, but since it was the only one Castle Rock could boast, it looked like they were pretty much stuck with it. There was general agreement with George's opinion. As the oldest resident of Castle Rock, Aunt Evie had held the Boston Post cane for the last 2 years, ever since Arnold Hebert, who had been 101 and so far gone in senility that talking to him held all the intellectual challenge of talking to an empty cat food can, had doddered off the back patio of the Castle Acres nursing home and broken his neck, exactly 25 minutes after whizzing in his pants for the last time. Aunt Evie was nowhere near as senile as Arnie Hebert had been, and nowhere near as old, but at 93 she was old enough, and as she was fond of bawling at a resigned and often hungover George Mira when he delivered the mail, she hadn't been stupid enough to lose her home the way Hebert had done. But she was good at the weather. The town consensus among the older people who cared about such things was that Aunt Evie was never wrong about three things: the week when the first hay cutting would happen in the summertime, how good or how bad the blueberries would be, and what the weather would be like. One day early that June, she shuffled out to the mailbox at the end of the driveway, leaning heavily on her Boston Post cane, which would go to Vin Marchant when the loud-mouthed old bitch popped off, George Mira thought, and good riddance to you, Evie, and smoking a Herbert Tarryton. She bellowed a greeting at Mira. Her deafness had apparently convinced her that everyone else in the world had gone deaf in sympathy, and then shouted that they were going to have the hottest summer in 30 years. "Hot early and hot late," Evie bellowed leather-lunged into the drowsy 11 o'clock quiet, "and hot in the middle." "That so?" George asked. What? I said, is that so? That was the other thing about Aunt Effie. She got you shouting right along with her. A man could pop a blood vessel.
I should hope to smile and kiss a pig if it ain't, Aunt Effie screamed.
The ash of her cigarette fell on the shoulder of George Mira's uniform blouse, freshly dry-cleaned and just put on clean this morning. He brushed it off resignedly. Aunt Effie leaned in the window of his car, all the better to bellow in his ear. Her breath smelled like sour cucumbers.
Field mice has all gone out of the root cellars. Tommy Nido seen deer out by Moosuntik Pond rubbing velvet off'n their antlers ere the first robin showed up. Grass under the snow where she melted. Green grass, Mira.
That's so, Evie, George replied, since some reply seemed necessary. He was getting a headache.
What? That's so, Aunt Evie? George Mira screamed.
Saliva flew from his lips.
Oh, Aya? Aunt Evie howled back contentedly. And I seen heat lightning last night late. Bad sign, Mira. Early heat's a bad sign. Bee people die of the heat this summer. It's gonna be a bad un.
I got to go, Aunt Evie, George yelled. Got a special delivery for Stringer Beaulieu.
Aunt Evie Chalmers threw her head back and cackled at the spring sky. She cackled until she was fit to choke, and more cigarette ashes rolled down the front of her house dress. She spat the last quarter inch of cigarette out of her mouth, and it lay moldering in the driveway by one of her old lady shoes, a shoe as black as a stove and as tight as a corset, a shoe for the ages.
You got a special delivery for Frenchy Beaulieu? Why, he couldn't read the name on his own tombstone.
I got to go, Aunt Evie, George said hastily and threw his car in gear.
Frenchy Beaulieu is a stark natural-born fool if God ever made one, Aunt Evie hollered.
But by then she was hollering into George Mira's dust. He had made good his escape. She stood there by her mailbox for a minute, watching him go. There was no personal mail for her. These days there rarely was. Most of the people she knew who had been able to write were now dead. She would follow soon enough, she suspected. The oncoming summer gave her a bad feeling, a scary feeling. She could speak of the mice leaving the root cellars early, or of heat lightning in a spring sky, but she could not speak of the heat she sensed somewhere just over the horizon, crouched like a scrawny yet powerful beast with mangy fur and red smoldering eyes. She could not speak of her dreams, which were hot and shadowless and thirsty. She could not speak of the morning when tears had come for no reason, tears that did not relieve, but stung the eyes like August mad sweat instead. She smelled lunacy in a wind that had not arrived.
"George Mira, you're an old fat," Aunt Evie said, giving the word a juicy main resonance which built it into something that was both cataclysmic and ludicrous.
Fat!
She began working her way back to the house, leaning on her Boston Post cane, which had been given her at a town hall ceremony for no more than the stupid accomplishment of growing old successfully. No wonder, she thought, the goddamn paper had gone broke. She paused on her stoop, looking at a sky which was still spring pure and pastel soft. Oh, but she sensed it coming. Something hot. Something foul. A year before that summer, when Vic Trenton's old Jaguar developed a distressing clunking sound somewhere inside the rear left wheel, it had been George Mira who recommended that he take it up to Joe Camber's garage on the outskirts of Castle Rock.
"He's got a funny way of doing things for around here," George told Vic that day as Vic stood by his mailbox. tells you what the job's gonna cost, then he does the job, and then he charges you what he said it was gonna cost. Funny way to do business, huh?
And he drove away, leaving Vic to wonder if the mailman had been serious, or if he, Vic, had just been on the receiving end of some obscure Yankee joke. But he had called Camber, and one day in July, a much cooler July than the one which would follow a year later, he and Donna and Tad had driven out to Camber's place together. It really was far out. Twice Vic had to stop and ask directions. And it was then that he began to call those farthest reaches of the township East Galosh's Corners. He pulled into the Camber dooryard, the back wheel clunking louder than ever. Tad, then three, was sitting on Donna Trenton's lap, laughing up at her. A ride in Daddy's no-top always put him in a fine mood, and Donna was feeling pretty fine herself. A boy of 8 or 9 was standing in the yard, hitting an old baseball with an even older baseball bat. The ball would travel through the air, strike the side of the barn, which Vic assumed was also Mr. Camber's garage, and then roll most of the way back.
"Hi," the boy said. "Are you Mr. Trenton?"
"That's right," Vic said.
"I'll get my dad,"
the boy said, and went into the barn. The three Trentons got out, and Vic walked around to the back of his jag and squatted by the bad wheel, not feeling very confident. Perhaps he should have tried to nurse the car into Portland after all. The situation out here didn't look very promising. Camber didn't even have a sign hung out. His meditations were broken by Donna, calling his name nervously, and then, "Oh, my God! Vic!" He got up quickly and saw a huge dog emerging from the barn. For one absurd moment, he wondered if it really was a dog, or maybe some strange and ugly species of pony. Then, as the dog padded out of the shadows of the barn's mouth, he saw its sad eyes and realized it was a Saint Bernard. Donna had impulsively snatched up Tad and retreated toward the hood of the jag, but Tad was struggling impatiently in her arms, trying to get down.
"Want to see the doggy, Mom? Want to see the doggy?"
Donna cast a nervous glance at Vic, who shrugged, also uneasy. Then the boy came back and ruffled the dog's head as he approached Vic. The dog wagged a tail that was absolutely huge, and Tad redoubled his struggles.
"You can let him down, ma'am," the boy said politely. "Cujo likes kids. He won't hurt him."
And then to Vic,
"My dad's coming right out. He's washing his hands."
"All right," Vic said. "That's one hell of a big dog, son. Are you sure he's safe?"
"He's safe,"
the boy agreed. But Vic found himself moving up beside his wife as his son, incredibly small, toddled toward the dog. Cujo stood with his head cocked, that great brush of a tail waving slowly back and forth.
"Vic,"
Donna began.
"It's all right," Vic said, thinking, "I hope."
The dog looked big enough to swallow the tatter in a single bite. Tad stopped for a moment, apparently doubtful. He and the dog looked at each other.
"Doggy?"
Tad said.
"Cujo,"
Camber's boy said, walking over to Tad.
"His name's Cujo."
"Cujo,"
Tad said, and the dog came to him and began to lick his face in great good-natured slobbery swipes that had Tad giggling and trying to fend him off. He turned back to his mother and father, laughing the way he did when one of them was tickling him. He took a step toward them, and his feet tangled in each other. He fell down, and suddenly the dog was moving toward him, over him. And Vic, who had his arm around Donna's waist, felt his wife's gasp as well as heard it. He started to move forward, and then stopped. Cujo's teeth had clamped on the back of Tad's Spider-Man T-shirt. He pulled the boy up. For a moment, Tad looked like a kitten in its mother's mouth, and set the boy on his feet. Tad ran back to his mother and father.
"Like the doggy, Mom. Dad, I like the doggy."
Camber's boy was watching this with mild amusement, his hands stuffed into the pockets of his jeans.
"Sure, it's a great dog," Vic said.
He was amused, but his heart was still beating fast. For just one moment there, he had really believed that the dog was going to bite off Tad's head like a lollipop.
"It's a Saint Bernard, Tad," he said.
"Saint Bernard!"
Tad cried and ran back toward Cujo, who was now sitting outside the mouth of the barn like a small mountain.
"Cujo! Cujo!"
Donna tensed beside Vic again. "Oh, Vic, do you think?" But now Tad was with Cujo again, first hugging him extravagantly and then looking closely at his face. With Cujo sitting down, his tail thumping on the gravel, his tongue lolling out pinkly, Tad could almost look into the dog's eyes by standing on tiptoe.
"I think they're fine," Vic said.
Tad had now put one of his small hands into Cujo's mouth and was peering in like the world's smallest dentist. That gave Vic another uneasy moment. But then Tad was running back to them again.
"Doggy's got teeth," he told Vic.
"Yes," Vic said, "lots of teeth."
He turned to the boy, meaning to ask him where he had come up with that name, but then Joe Camber was coming out of the barn, wiping his hands on a piece of waste so he could shake without getting Vic greasy. Vic was pleasantly surprised to find that Camber knew exactly what he was doing. He listened carefully to the clunking sound as he and Vic drove down to the house at the bottom of the hill and then back up to Camber's place.
"Wheelbarin's going," Camber said briefly. "You're lucky it ain't froze up on you already."
"Can you fix it?" Vic asked.
"Oh, yeah. Fix it right now if you don't mind hanging around for a couple of hours."
"That'd be all right, I guess," Vic said. He looked toward Tad and the dog. Tad had gotten the baseball Camber's son had been hitting. He would throw it as far as he could, which wasn't very far, and the Camber's St. Bernard would obediently get it and bring it back to Tad. The ball was looking decidedly slobbery.
"Your dog is keeping my son amused." "Cujo likes kids," Camber agreed. "You want to drive your car into the barn, Mr. Trenton?"
"The doctor will see you now," Vic thought, amused, and drove the Jag in. As it turned out, the job only took an hour and a half, and Camber's price was so reasonable it was startling. And Tad ran through that cool, overcast afternoon, calling the dog's name over and over again.
"Cujo! Cujo! Here, Cujo!"
Just before they left, Camber's boy, whose name was Brett, actually lifted Tad onto Cujo's back and held him around the waist while Cujo padded obediently up and down the gravel dooryard twice. As it passed Vic, the dog caught his eye, and Vic would have sworn it was laughing. Just 3 days after George Mira's bellowed conversation with Aunt Evie Chalmers, a little girl who was exactly Tad Trenton's age stood up from her place at the breakfast table, said breakfast table being in the breakfast nook of a tidy little house in Iowa City, Iowa, and announced,
"Oh, Mama, I don't feel so good. I feel like I'm going to be sick."
Her mother looked around, not exactly surprised. 2 days before, Marcy's bigger brother had been sent from school with a raging case of stomach flu. Brock was all right now, but he had spent a lousy 24 hours, his body enthusiastically throwing off ballast from both ends.
"Are you sure, honey?" Marcy's mother said.
Marcy moaned loudly and lurched toward the downstairs hall, her hands laced over her stomach. Her mother followed her, saw Marcy buttonhook into the bathroom, and thought, "Oh, boy, here we go again. If I don't catch this, it'll be a miracle." She heard the retching sounds begin and turned into the bathroom, her mind already occupied with the details. clear liquids, bed rest, the chamber pot, some books. Brock could take the portable TV up to her room when he got back from school, and she looked, and these thoughts were driven from her mind with the force of a roundhouse slap. The toilet bowl where her 4-year-old daughter had vomited was full of blood. Blood splattered the white porcelain lip of the bowl. Blood beaded the tiles.
Oh, Mommy, I don't feel good.
Her daughter turned. Her daughter turned, turned, and there was blood all over her mouth. It was down her chin. It was matting her blue sailor dress. Blood. Oh, dear God, dear Jesus, Joseph, and Mary, so much blood.
Mommy?
And her daughter did it again, a huge bloody mess flying from her mouth to patter down everywhere like sinister rain. And then Marcy's mother gathered her up and ran with her, ran for the phone in the kitchen to dial the emergency unit. Cujo knew he was too old to chase rabbits. He wasn't old, no, not even for a dog, but at 5 he was well past his puppyhood, when even a butterfly had been enough to set off an arduous chase through the woods and meadows behind the house and barn. He was 5, and if he had been a human, he would have been entering the youngest stage of middle age. But it was the 16th of June, a beautiful early morning, the dew still on the grass. The heat Aunt Evie had predicted to George Mira had indeed arrived. It was the warmest early June in years, and by 2 that afternoon Cujo would be lying in the dusty dooryard, or in the barn, if the man would let him in, which he sometimes did when he was drinking, which was most of the time these days, panting under the hot sun. But that was later. And the rabbit, which was large, brown, and plump, didn't have the slightest idea Cujo was there, down near the end of the north field, a mile from the house. The wind was blowing the wrong way for Br'er Rabbit. Cujo worked toward the rabbit, out for sport rather than meat. The rabbit munched happily away at new clover that would be baked and brown under the relentless sun a month later. If he had only covered half the original distance between himself and the rabbit when the rabbit saw him and bolted, Cujo would have let it go. But he had actually got to within 15 yards of it when the rabbit's head and ears came up. For a moment the rabbit did not move at all. It was a frozen rabbit sculpture with black wall eyes bulging comically. Then it was off. Barking furiously, Cujo gave chase. The rabbit was very small, and Cujo was very big, but the possibility of the thing put an extra ration of energy in Cujo's legs. He actually got close enough to paw at the rabbit. The rabbit zigged. Cujo came around more ponderously, his claws digging black meadow dirt, losing some ground at first, making it up quickly. Birds took wing at his heavy, chopping bark. If it is possible for a dog to grin, Cujo was grinning then. The rabbit zagged, then made straight across the north field. Cujo pelted after it, already suspecting this was one race he wasn't going to win. But he tried hard, and he was gaining on the rabbit again when it dropped into a small hole in the side of a small and easy hill. The hole was overgrown by long grasses, and Cujo didn't hesitate. He lowered his big tawny body into a kind of furry projectile and let his forward motion carry him in, where he promptly stuck like a cork in a bottle. Joe Camber had owned Seven Oaks Farm out at the end of Town Road Number 3 for 17 years, but he had no idea this hole was here. He surely would have discovered it if farming was his business, but it wasn't. There was no livestock in the big red barn. It was his garage and auto body shop. His son Brett rambled the fields and woods behind the home place frequently, but he had never noticed the hole either, although on several occasions he had nearly put his foot in it, which might have earned him a broken ankle. On clear days the hole could pass for a shadow, On cloudy days, overgrown with grass as it was, it disappeared altogether. John Mousam, the farm's previous owner, had known about the hole, but had never thought to mention it to Joe Camber when Joe bought the place in 1963. He might have mentioned it as a caution when Joe and his wife Charity had their son in 1970, but by then the cancer had carried old John off. It was just as well Brett had never found it. There's nothing in the world quite so interesting to a boy as a hole in the ground, and this one opened on a small natural limestone cave. It was about 20 feet deep at its deepest, and it would have been quite possible for a small squirty boy to eel his way in, slide to the bottom, and then find it impossible to get out. It had happened to other small animals in the past. The cave's limestone surface made a good slide, but a bad climb, and its bottom was littered with bones, a woodchuck, a skunk, a couple of chipmunks, a couple of squirrels, and a house cat. The house cat's name had been Mr. Clean. The Cambers had lost him 2 years before and assumed he had been hit by a car or had just run off. But here he was, along with the bones of the good-sized field mouse he had chased inside. Cujo's rabbit had rolled and slid all the way to the bottom, and now quivered there, ears up and nose vibrating like a tuning fork, as Cujo's furious barking filled the place. The echoes made it sound as though there was a whole pack of dogs up there. The small cave had also attracted bats from time to time, never many because the cave was only a small one, but its rough ceiling made a perfect place for them to roost upside down and snooze the daylight away. The bats were another good reason that Brett Camber had been lucky, especially this year. This year the brown insectivorous bats inhabiting the small cave were crawling with a particularly virulent strain of rabies. Cujo had stuck at the shoulders. He dug furiously with his back legs to no effect at all. He could have reversed and pulled himself back out, but for now he still wanted the rabbit. He sensed it was trapped, his for the taking. His eyes were not particularly keen. His large body blocked out almost all the light anyway, and he had no sense of the drop just beyond his front paws. He could smell damp, and he could smell bat guano, both old and fresh. But most important of all, he could smell rabbit, hot and tasty. Dinner is served. His barking roused the bats. They were terrified. Something had invaded their home. They flew en masse toward the exit, squeaking. But their sonar recorded a puzzling and distressing fact. The entrance was no longer there. The predator was where the entrance had been. They wheeled and swooped in the darkness, their membranous wings sounding like small pieces of clothing, diapers, perhaps, flapping from a line in a gusty wind. Below them, the rabbit cringed and hoped for the best. Cujo felt several of the bats flutter against the third of him that had managed to get into the hole, and he became frightened. He didn't like their scent or their sound. He didn't like the odd heat that seemed to emanate from them. He barked louder and snapped at the things that were wheeling and squeaking around his head. His snapping jaws closed on one brown-black wing. Bones thinner than those in a baby's hand crunched. The bat slashed and bit at him, slicing open the skin of the dog's sensitive muzzle in a long, curving wound that was shaped like a question mark. A moment later, it went skittering and cartwheeling down the limestone slope, already dying. But the damage had been done. A bite from a rabid animal is most serious around the head, for rabies is a disease of the central nervous system. Dogs, more susceptible than their human masters, cannot even hope for complete protection from the inactivated virus vaccine which every veterinarian administers. And Cujo had never had a single rabies shot in his life.
Not knowing this, but knowing that the unseen thing he had bitten had tasted foul and horrible, Cujo decided the game was not worth the candle. With a tremendous yank of his shoulders, he pulled himself out of the hole, causing a little avalanche of dirt. He shook himself, and more dirt and smelly crumbled limestone flew from his pelt. Blood dripped from his muzzle. He sat down, tilted his head skyward, and uttered a single low howl. The bats exited their hole in a small brown cloud, whirled confusedly in the bright June sunshine for a couple of seconds, and then went back in to roost. They were brainless things, and within the course of 2 or 3 minutes they had forgotten all about the barking interloper and were sleeping again, hung from their heels with their wings wrapped around their ratty little bodies like the shawls of old women. Cujo trotted away. He shook himself again. He pawed helplessly at his muzzle. The blood was already clotting, drying to a cake, but it hurt. Dogs have a sense of self-consciousness that is far out of proportion to their intelligence, and Cujo was disgusted with himself. He didn't want to go home. If he went home, one of his trinity, the man, the woman, or the boy, would see that he had done something to himself. It was possible that one of them might call him bad dog, and at this particular moment he certainly considered himself to be a bad dog. So, instead of going home, Cujo went down to the stream that separated Camber Land from the property of Gary Pervier, the Camber's nearest neighbor. He waded upstream. He drank deeply. He rolled over in the water, trying to get rid of the nasty taste in his mouth, trying to get rid of the dirt and the watery green stink of limestone, trying to get rid of that bad dog feeling. Little by little, he began to feel better. He came out of the stream and shook himself, the spray of water forming a momentary rainbow of breathless clarity in the air. The bad dog feeling was fading, and so was the pain in his nose. He started up toward the house to see if the boy might be around. He had gotten used to the big yellow school bus that came to pick the boy up every morning and which dropped him back off again in mid-afternoon, but this last week the school bus had not shown up with its flashing eyes and its yelling cargo of children. The boy was always at home. Usually he was out in the barn, doing things with the man. Maybe the yellow school bus had come again today. Maybe not. He would see. He had forgotten about the hole and the nasty taste of the bat wing. His nose hardly hurt at all now. Cujo breasted his way easily through the high grass of the north field, driving up an occasional bird, but not bothering to give chase. He had had his chase for the day, and his body remembered even if his brain did not. He was a St. Bernard in his prime, 5 years old, nearly 200 pounds in weight, and now, on the morning of June 16, 1980, he was pre-rabid. 7 days later, and 30 miles from Seven Oaks Farm in Castle Rock, two men met in a downtown Portland restaurant called the Yellow Submarine. The sub featured a large selection of hero sandwiches, pizzas, and Dagwoods in Lebanese pouches. There was a pinball machine in the back. There was a sign over the counter saying that if you could eat 2 yellow sub nightmares, you ate free. Below that, in parenthesis, the codicil, "If you puke, you pay," had been added. Ordinarily, there was nothing Vic Trenton would have liked better than one of the Yellow Sub's meatball heroes. But he suspected he would get nothing from today's but a really good case of acid burn. "Looks like we're going to lose the ball, doesn't it?" Vic said to the other man, who was regarding a Danish ham with a marked lack of enthusiasm. The other man was Roger Breakstone. And when he looked at food without enthusiasm, you knew that some sort of cataclysm was at hand. Roger weighed 270 pounds and had no lap when he sat down.
Once, when the two of them had been in bed with a kids at camp case of the giggles, Donna had told Vic she thought Roger's lap had been shot off in Vietnam.
"It looks piss poor," Roger admitted. "It looks so fucking piss poor you wouldn't believe it, Victor, old buddy."
"You really think making this trip will solve anything?"
"Maybe not," Roger said, "but we're going to lose the Sharp account for sure if we don't go. Maybe we can salvage something, work our way back in."
He bit into his sandwich. "Closing up for 10 days is going to hurt us."
"You think we're not hurting now?"
"Sure, we're hurting, but we've got those book folk spots to shoot down at Kennebunk Beach. Risa can handle that."
"I'm not entirely convinced that Lisa can handle her own love life, let alone the book folks' spots," Vic said.
"But even supposing she can handle it, the Your Choice Blueberry series is still hanging fire. Casco Bank and Trust. And you're supposed to meet with the head honcho from the Maine Realtors Association."
"Uh-uh. That's yours."
"Fuck you, it's mine," Vic said. "I break up every time I think of those red pants and white shoes. I kept wanting to look in the closet to see if I could find the guy a sandwich board."
"It doesn't matter, and you know it doesn't. None of them bills a tenth of what Sharp bills. What else can I say? You know Sharp and the kid are going to want to talk to both of us." "Do I book you a seat or not?"
The thought of 10 days, 5 in Boston and 5 in New York, gave Vic a mild case of the cold sweats. He and Roger had both worked for the Ellison Agency in New York for 6 years. Vic now had a home in Castle Rock. Roger and Althea Breakstone lived in neighboring Bridgeton, about 15 miles away. For Vic, it had been a case of never even wanting to look back. He felt he had never come fully alive, had never really known what he was for until he and Donna moved to Maine. And now he had a morbid sense that New York had only been waiting these last 3 years to get him in its clutches again. The plane would skid off the runway coming in and be engulfed in a roaring fire cloud of high-test jet fuel. Or there would be a crash on the Triborough Bridge, their checker crushed into a bleeding yellow accordion. A mugger would use his gun instead of just waving it. A gas main would explode, and he would be decapitated by a manhole cover flying through the air like a deadly 90-pound frisbee. Something. If he went back, the city would kill him. "Raj," he said, putting down his meatball sandwich after one small bite, "have you ever thought that it might not be the end of the world if we did lose the Sharp account?"
"The world will go on," Roger said, pouring a bush down the side of a Pilsner glass. "But will we? Me, I've got 17 years left on a 20-year mortgage and twin girls who have their hearts set on Bridgeton Academy. You've got your own mortgage, your own kid, plus that old Jag Sportster that's going to half-buck you to death."
"Yes, but the local economy..."
"The local economy sucks," Roger exclaimed violently and set his Pilsner glass down with a bang.
A party of four at the next table, three in UMP tennis shirts and one wearing a faded T-shirt with the legend, "Darth Vader is Gay," written across the front, began to applaud. Roger waved a hand at them impatiently and leaned toward Vic.
"We're not going to make it happen doing campaigns for Your Choice Blueberries and the Maine Realtors, and you know it. If we lose the Sharp account, we're going to go under without a ripple. On the other hand, if we can keep even a piece of Sharp over the next 2 years, we'll be in line for some of the Department of Tourism budget, maybe even a crack at the state lottery if they don't mismanage it into oblivion by then. Juicy pies, Vic. We can wave so long to Sharp and their crappy cereals, and there's happy endings all around. The big bad wolf has to go somewhere else to get his dinner. These little piggies are home free."
"All contingent on us being able to save something," Vic said.
which is about as likely as the Cleveland Indians winning the World Series this fall. I think we better try, buddy. Vic sat silent, looking at his congealing sandwich and thinking. It was totally unfair, but he could live with unfairness. What really hurt was the whole situation's crazed absurdity. It had blown up out of a clear sky like a killer tornado that lays a zigzagging trail of destruction and then disappears. He and Roger and AdWorks itself were apt to be numbered among the fatalities no matter what they did. He could read it on Roger's round face, which had not looked so pallidly serious since he and Althea had lost their boy Timothy to the crib death syndrome when the infant was only 9 days old. 3 weeks after that happened, Roger had broken down and wept, his hands plastered to his fat face in a kind of terrible, hopeless sorrow that had squeezed Vic's heart into his throat. That had been bad. But the incipient panic he saw in Roger's eyes now was bad, too. Tornadoes blew out of nowhere in the advertising business from time to time. A big outfit like the Ellison Agency, which billed in the millions, could withstand them. A little one, like AdWorks, just couldn't. They had been carrying one basket with a lot of little eggs in it, and another basket with one big egg, the Sharp account. And it now remained to be seen whether the big egg had been lost entirely, or if it could at least be scrambled. None of it had been their fault, but ad agencies make lovely whipping boys. Vic and Roger had teamed naturally together ever since their first joint effort at the Ellison Agency 6 years ago. Vic, tall and skinny and rather quiet, had formed the perfect yin for Roger Breakstone's fat, happy, and extroverted yang. They had clicked on a personal basis and on a professional one. That first assignment had been a minor one, to submit a magazine ad campaign for United Cerebral Palsy. They had come up with a stark black-and-white ad that showed a small boy in huge, cruel leg braces standing in foul territory by the first baseline of a little league ball field. A New York Mets cap was perched on his head, and his expression, Roger had always maintained that it had been the boy's expression which sold the ad, wasn't sad at all. It was simply dreamy. Almost happy, in fact. The copy read simply, "Billy Bellamy is never going to bat cleanup." Beneath, "Billy has cerebral palsy." Beneath that, smaller type, "Give us a hand, huh?" CP donations had taken a noticeable leap. Good for them, good for Vic and Roger. The team of Trenton and Breakstone had been off and running. Half a dozen successful campaigns had followed, Vic dealing most commonly with broad-scope conception, Roger dealing with actual execution. For the Sony Corporation, a picture of a man sitting cross-legged on the median strip of a 16-lane superhighway in a business suit, a big Sony radio on his lap, a seraphic smile on his kisser. The copy read, "Police Band, The Rolling Stones, Vivaldi, Mike Wallace, The Kingston Trio, Paul Harvey, Patti Smith, Jerry Falwell." And below that, "Hello, L.A." For the Voigt people, makers of swim equipment, an ad that showed a man who was the utter antithesis of the Miami Beach boy, standing arrogantly hip-shot on the golden beach of some tropical paradise. The model was a 50-year-old man with tattoos, a beer belly, slab-muscled arms and legs, and a puckered scar high across one thigh. In his arms, this battered soldier of fortune was cradling a pair of Voigt swim fins. "Mister," the copy for this one read, "I dive for a living. I don't mess around." There was a lot more underneath, stuff Roger always referred to as the blah-blah, but the copy set in bold face was the real hooker. Vic and Roger had wanted it to read, "I don't screw around," but they hadn't been able to sell the Voigt people on that.
Pity, Vic was fond of saying over drinks. They could have sold a lot more swim fins. Then there was Sharp. The Sharp Company of Cleveland had stood 12th in the Great American Bake Stakes when Old Man Sharp reluctantly came to the Ellison Agency in New York after more than 20 years with a hometown ad agency. Sharp had been bigger than Nabisco before World War II, the old man was fond of pointing out. His son was just as fond of pointing out that World War II had ended 30 years ago. The account, on a 6-month trial basis at first, had been handed over to Vic Trenton and Roger Breakstone. At the end of the trial period, Sharp had vaulted from 12th in the cookies, cakes, and cereals market to 9th. A year later, when Vic and Roger pulled up stakes and moved to Maine to open up their own business, the Sharp Company had climbed to 7th. Their campaign had been a sweeping one. For Sharp Cookies, Vic and Roger had developed the Cookie Sharpshooter, a bumbling Western peace officer whose 6 guns shot cookies instead of bullets, courtesy of the special effects people. Chocolate chippers in some spots, ginger snappies in others. Oh, those oatmeals in still others. The spots always ended with the sharpshooter standing sadly in a pile of cookies with his guns out. Well, the bad guys got away, he'd tell millions of Americans every day or so, but I got the cookies. Best cookies in the West, or anywhere else, I reckon. The sharpshooter bites into a cookie. His expression suggests that he is experiencing the gastronomic equivalent of a boy's first orgasm. Fade out. For the prepared cakes, 16 different varieties ranging from pound to crumb to cheese, there was what Vic called the George and Gracie spot. We fade in on George and Gracie, leaving a posh dinner party where the buffet table groans with every possible delicacy. We dissolve to a dingy little cold water flat, starkly lighted. George is sitting at a plain kitchen table with a checked tablecloth. Gracie takes a sharp pound cake, or cheesecake, or crumb cake, from the freezer of their old refrigerator and sets it on the table. They are both still in their evening clothes. They smile into each other's eyes with warmth and love and understanding, two people who are utterly in sync with each other. Fade to these words on black. Sometimes all you want is a sharp cake. Not a word spoken in the entire spot. That one had won a Clio. As had the Sharp cereal professor, hailed in the trades as the most responsible advertisement ever produced for children's programming. Vic and Roger had considered it their crowning achievement. But now it was the Sharp cereal professor who had come back to haunt them. Played by a character actor in late middle age, the Sharp cereal professor was a low-key and daringly adult advertisement in a sea of animated kiddie vid ads selling bubblegum, adventure toys, dolls, action figures, and rival cereals. The ad faded in on a deserted 4th or 5th grade classroom. A scene Saturday morning viewers of the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour and the Drac Pack could readily identify with. The Sharp cereal professor was wearing a suit, a V-necked sweater, and a shirt open at the collar. Both in looks and in speech, he was mildly authoritarian. Vic and Roger had talked to some 40 teachers and half a dozen child psychiatrists and had discovered that this was the sort of parental role model that the majority of kids feel most comfortable with, and the sort that so few actually have in their homes. The cereal professor was sitting on a teacher's desk, hinting at some informality, the soul of a real pal hidden somewhere beneath that gray-green tweed, the young viewer might assume. But he spoke slowly and gravely. He did not command. He did not talk down. He did not wheedle. He did not cajole or extol. He spoke to the millions of T-shirted, cereal-slurping, cartoon-watching Saturday morning viewers as though they were real people. "Good morning, children," the professor said quietly. This is a commercial for cereal. Listen to me carefully, please. I know a lot about cereals because I'm the Sharp Cereal Professor. Sharp cereals, Twinkles, Cocoa Bears, Bran 16, and Sharp All Grain Blend are the best-tasting cereals in America. And they're good for you. A beat of silence. And then the Sharp Cereal Professor grinned. And when he grinned, you knew there was the soul of a real pal in there. Believe me, because I know. Your mom knows. I just thought you'd like to know, too. A young man came into the ad at that point, and he handed the Sharp Cereal Professor a bowl of Twinkles or Cocoa Bears or whatever. The Sharp Cereal Professor dug in, then looked straight into every living room in the country and said, "Nope, nothing wrong here." Old Man Sharp hadn't cared for that last line, or the idea that anything could be wrong with one of his cereals. Eventually, Vic and Roger had worn him down, but not with rational arguments. Making ads was not a rational business. You often did what felt right, but that didn't mean you could understand why it felt right. Both Vic and Roger felt that the professor's final line had a power which was both simple and enormous. Coming from the cereal professor, it was the final total comfort, a complete security blanket. "I'll never hurt you," it implied. In a world where parents get divorced, where older kids sometimes beat the shit out of you for no rational reason, where the rival little league team sometimes racks the crap out of your pitching, where the good guys don't always win like they do on TV, where you don't always get invited to the good birthday party, in a world where so much goes wrong, there will always be Twinkles and Cocoa Bears and All Grain Blend. And they'll always taste good. Nope, nothing wrong here. With a little help from Sharp's son, later on, Roger said, you would have believed the kid thought the ad up and wrote it himself, the Cereal Professor concept was approved and saturated Saturday morning TV, plus such weekly syndicated programs as Star Blazers, U.S. of Archie, Hogan's Heroes, and Gilligan's Island. Sharp cereals surged even more powerfully than the rest of the Sharp line, and the Cereal Professor became an American institution. His tagline, "Nope, nothing wrong here," became one of those national catchphrases, meaning roughly the same thing as "stay cool" and "no sweat." When Vic and Roger decided to go their own way, they had observed strict protocol and had not gone to any of their previous clients until their connections with the Ellison Agency were formally and amicably severed. Their first 6 months in Portland had been a scary pressure cooker time for all of them. Vic and Donna's boy Tad was only a year old. Donna, who missed New York badly, was by turns sullen, petulant, and just plain scared. Roger had an old ulcer, a battle scar from his years in the Big Apple advertising wars, and when he and Althea lost the baby, the ulcer had flared up again, turning him into a closet Jellusil chugger. Althea bounced back as well as possible under the circumstances, Vic thought. It was Donna who pointed out to him that placid Althea's single weak drink before dinner had turned into two before and three after. The two couples had vacationed in Maine, separately and together. But neither Vic nor Roger had realized how many doors are initially closed to folks who have moved in, as Mainers say, from out of state. They would indeed have gone under, as Roger pointed out, if Sharp hadn't decided to stay with them. And at the company's Cleveland headquarters, positions had done an ironic flip-flop. Now it was the old man who wanted to stick with Vic and Roger, and it was the kid, by this time 40 years old, who wanted to jettison them, arguing with some logic that it would be madness to hand their account over to a 2-bit ad agency 600 miles north of the New York Pulse Beat. The fact that AdWorks was affiliated with a New York market analysis firm cut zero ice with the kid, as it had cut zero ice with the other firms for which they had put together campaigns in the past few years.
"If loyalty was toilet paper," Roger had said bitterly, "we'd be hard-pressed to wipe our asses, old buddy."
But Sharp had come along, providing the margin they had so desperately needed.
"We may do with an ad agency here in town for 40 years, old man Sharp said. "And if those two boys want to move out of that Christless city, they're just showing good old common sense."
That was that. The old man had spoken. The kid shut up. And for the last 2.5 years, the cookie sharpshooter had gone on shooting. George and Gracie had gone on eating sharp cakes in their cold water flat, and the sharp cereal professor had gone on telling kids that there was nothing wrong here. Actual spot production was handled by a small independent studio in Boston. The New York market analysis firm went on doing its thing competently, and 3 or 4 times a year either Vic or Roger flew to Cleveland to confer with Carol Sharp and his kid, said kid now going decidedly gray around the temples. All the rest of the client-agency intercourse was handled by the U.S. Post Office and Ma Bell. The process was perhaps strange, certainly cumbersome, but it seemed to work fine. Then along came Red Raspberry Zingers. Vic and Roger had known about Zingers for some time, of course, although it had only gone on the general market some 2 months ago, in April of 1980. Most of the sharp cereals were lightly sweetened or not sweetened at all. All-grain blend, Sharp's entry in the natural cereal arena, had been quite successful. Red Raspberry Zingers, however, was aimed at a segment of the market with a sweeter tooth, at those prepared cereal eaters who bought such cereals as Count Chocula, Frankenberry, Lucky Charms, and similar pre-sweetened breakfast foods which were somewhere in the twilight zone between cereal and candy. In the late summer and early fall of 1979, Zingers had been successfully test-marketed in Boise, Idaho, Scranton, Pennsylvania, and in Roger's adopted Maine hometown of Bridgeton. Roger had told Vic with a shudder that he wouldn't let the twins near it with a 10-foot pole, although he had been pleased when Althea told him the kids had clamored for it when they saw it shelved at Giguere's Market.
"It's got more sugar than whole grain in it, and it looks like the side of a fire barn."
Vic had nodded and replied innocently enough, with no sense of prophecy, "The first time I looked in one of those boxes, I thought it was full of blood."
"So, what do you think?" Roger repeated.
He had made it halfway through his sandwich as Vic reviewed the dismal train of events in his mind. He was becoming more and more sure that in Cleveland, old man Sharp and his aging kid were looking again to shoot the messenger for the message.
"Guess we better try." Roger clapped him on the shoulder. "My man," he said. "Now, eat up."
But Vic wasn't hungry. The two of them had been invited to Cleveland to attend an emergency meeting that was to be held 3 weeks after the 4th of July. A good many of the Sharp regional sales managers and executives were vacationing, and it would take at least that long to get them all together. One of the items on the agenda had to do directly with AdWorks, an assessment of the association to this point, the letter had said. Which meant, Vic assumed, that the kid was using the Zingers debacle to dump them at last. About 3 weeks after Red Raspberry Zingers went national, enthusiastically, if gravely, pitched by the sharp cereal professor, "Nope, nothing wrong here," the first mother had taken her little one to the hospital, nearly hysterical, and sure the child was bleeding internally. The little girl, victim of nothing more serious than a low-grade virus, had thrown up what her mother had first believed to be a huge amount of blood. Nope, nothing wrong here. That had been in Iowa City, Iowa. The following day, there had been 7 more cases. The day after, 24. In all cases, the parents of children afflicted with vomiting or diarrhea had rushed the kids to the hospital, believing them to be suffering internal bleeding. After that, the cases had skyrocketed, first into the hundreds, then into the thousands. In none of these cases had the vomiting and/or diarrhea been caused by the cereal, but that was generally overlooked in the growing furor. Nope, not a single thing wrong here. The cases had spread west to east. The problem was the food dye that gave zingers its zingy red color. The dye itself was harmless, but that was also mostly overlooked. Something had gone wrong, and instead of assimilating the red dye, the human body simply passed it along. The goofed-up dye had only gotten into one batch of cereal, but it had been a whopper of a batch. A doctor told Vic that if a child who had just died after ingesting a big bowl of red raspberry zingers were the subject of an autopsy, the postmortem would reveal a digestive tract as red as a stop sign. The effect was strictly temporary, but that had been overlooked, too. Roger wanted them to go down with all guns firing if they were to go down. He had proposed marathon conferences with the Image Eye people in Boston who actually did the spots. He wanted to talk with the sharp serial professor himself, who had gotten so involved with his role that he was mentally and emotionally torn up over what had happened. Then on to New York to talk to the marketing people. Most important, it would be almost 2 weeks at Boston's Ritz-Carlton and at New York's UN Plaza. 2 weeks Vic and Roger would spend mostly in each other's hip pockets, digesting the input and brainstorming as they had in the old days. What Roger hoped would come out of it was a rebound campaign that would blow the socks off both Old Man Sharp and the kid. Instead of going to Cleveland with their necks shaved for the drop of the guillotine blade, they would show up with battle plans drawn to reverse the effects of the zinger snafu. That was the theory. In practice, they both realized that their chances were about as good as they were for a pitcher who deliberately sets out to throw a no-hitter. Vic had other problems. For the last 8 months or so, he had sensed that he and his wife were drifting slowly apart. He still loved her, and he damn near idolized Tad. But things had gone from a little uneasy to bad, and he sensed that there were worse things and worse times waiting. Just over the horizon, maybe. This trip, a grand tour from Boston to New York to Cleveland, coming at what should have been their at-home season, their doing-things-together season, was maybe not such a hot idea. When he looked at her face lately, he saw a stranger lurking just below its planes and angles and curves. And the question, it played over and over in his mind on nights when he wasn't able to sleep. And such nights had become more common lately. Had she taken a lover? They sure didn't sleep together much anymore. Had she done it? He hoped it wasn't so. But what did he think? Really? Tell the truth, Mr. Trenton, or you'll be forced to pay the consequences. He wasn't sure. He didn't want to be sure. He was afraid that if he became sure, the marriage would end. He was still completely gone on her, had never so much as considered an extramarital fling, and he could forgive her much, but not being cuckolded in his own home. You don't want to wear those horns. They grow out of your ears, and kids laugh at the funny man on the street. He... What? Vic said, emerging from his reverie. I missed it, Raj. I said that goddamn red cereal, unquote.
by exact words.
Yeah, Vic said. I'll drink to that.
Roger raised his Pilsner glass.
Do it, he said.
Vic did. Gary Pervier sat out on his weedy front lawn at the bottom of Seven Oaks Hill on Town Road Number 3 about a week after Vic and Roger's depressing luncheon meeting at the Yellow Sub, drinking a screwdriver that was 25% bird's-eye frozen orange juice and 75% pop-off vodka. He sat in the shade of an elm that was in the last stages of rampant Dutch elm disease, his bottom resting against the frayed straps of a Sears Roebuck mail-order lawn chair that was in the last stages of useful service. He was drinking Popoff because Popoff was cheap. Gary had purchased a large supply of it in New Hampshire, where booze was cheaper, on his last liquor run. Popoff was cheap in Maine, but it was dirt cheap in New Hampshire, a state which took its stand for the finer things in life, a fat state lottery, cheap booze, cheap cigarettes, and tourist attractions like Santa's Village and Six Gun City. New Hampshire was a great old place. The lawn chair had slowly settled into his run-to-riot lawn, digging deep divots. The house behind the lawn had also run to riot. It was a gray, paint-peeling, roof-sagging shambles. Shutters hung. The chimney hooked at the sky like a drunk trying to get up from a tumble. Shingles blown off in the previous winter's last big storm still hung limply from some of the branches of the dying elm. "It ain't the Taj Mahal," Gary sometimes said. "But who gives a shit?" Gary was, on this swelteringly hot late June day, as drunk as a coot. This was not an uncommon state of affairs with him. He did not know Roger Breakstone from shit. He did not know Vic Trenton from shit. He didn't know Donna Trenton from shit, and if he had known her, he wouldn't have given a shit if the visiting team was throwing line drives into her catcher's mitt. He did know the Cambers and their dog Cujo. The family lived up the hill at the end of Town Road Number 3. He and Joe Camber did a good deal of drinking together, and in a rather foggy fashion, Gary realized that Joe Camber was already a goodly way down the road to alcoholism. It was a road Gary himself had toured extensively.
"Just a good-for-nothing drunk, and I don't give a shit," Gary told the birds and the shingles in the diseased elm.
He tipped his glass. He farted. He swatted a bug. Sunlight and shadow dappled his face. Behind the house, a number of disemboweled cars had almost disappeared in the tall weeds. The ivy which grew on the west side of his house had gone absolutely apeshit, almost covering it. One window peeked out, barely, and on sunny days it glittered like a dirty diamond. 2 years ago, in a drunken frenzy, Gary had uprooted a bureau from one of the upstairs rooms and had thrown it out a window. He could not remember why now. He had reglazed the window himself because it had let in one crotch of a draft come winter, but the bureau rested exactly where it had fallen. One drawer was popped out like a tongue. In 1944, when Gary Pervier had been 20, he had single-handedly taken a German pillbox in France, and following that exploit had led the remains of his squad 10 miles farther before collapsing with the 6 bullet wounds he had suffered in his charge of the machine gun emplacement. For this, he had been awarded one of his grateful country's highest honors, the Distinguished Service Cross. In 1968, he had gotten Buddy Torgerson down in Castle Falls to turn the medal into an ashtray. Buddy had been shocked. Gary told Buddy he would have gotten him to make it into a toilet bowl so he could shit in it, but it wasn't big enough. Buddy spread the story, and maybe that had been Gary's intention. Or maybe it hadn't. Either way, it had driven the local hippies crazy with admiration. In the summer of 68, most of these hippies were on vacation in the Lakes region with their wealthy parents before returning to their colleges in September, where they were apparently studying up on protest, pot, and pussy.
After Gary had his DSC turned into an ashtray by Buddy Torgerson, who did custom welding in his spare time and who worked days down to the Castle Falls Esso, they were all Exxon stations now, and Gary Pervier didn't give a shit. A version of the story found its way into the Castle Rock Call. The story was written by a local yokel reporter who construed the act as an anti-war gesture. That was when the hippies started to show up at Gary's place on Town Road Number 3. Most of them wanted to tell Gary he was far out. Some of them wanted to tell him he was some kind of heavy. A few wanted to tell him he was too fucking much. Gary showed them all the same thing, which was his Winchester 30-06. He told them to get off his property. As far as he was concerned, they were all a bunch of long-haired, muff-diving, crab-crawling, asshole, pinko fucksticks. He told them he didn't give a shit if he blew their guts from Castle Rock to Freiburg. After a while, they stopped coming, and that was the end of the DSC affair. One of those German bullets had taken Gary Pervier's right testicle off. A medic had found most of it splattered across the seat of his GI-issue underwear. Most of the other one survived, and sometimes he could still get a pretty respectable bone on. Not, he had frequently told Joe Camber, that he gave much of a shit one way or the other. His grateful country had given him the Distinguished Service Cross. A grateful hospital staff in Paris had discharged him in February 1945 with an 80% disability pension and a gold-plated monkey on his back. A grateful hometown gave him a parade on the 4th of July 1945. By then he was 21 instead of 20, able to vote, his hair graying around the temples, and he felt all of 700, thank you very much. The grateful town selectmen had remanded the property taxes on the Pervier place in perpetuity. That was good, because he would have lost it 20 years ago otherwise. He had replaced the morphine he could no longer obtain with high-tension booze, and had then proceeded to get about his life's work, which was killing himself as slowly and as pleasantly as he could. Now, in 1980, he was 56 years old, totally gray, and meaner than a bull with a jackhandle up its ass. About the only three living creatures he could stand were Joe Camber, his boy Brett, and Brett's big St. Bernard, Cujo. He tilted back in the decaying lawn chair, almost went over on his back, and used up some more of his screwdriver. The screwdriver was in a glass he had gotten free from a McDonald's restaurant. There was some sort of purple animal on the glass, something called a grimace. Gary ate a lot of his meals at the Castle Rock McDonald's, where you could still get a cheap hamburger. Hamburgers were good, but as for the grimace and Mayor McCheese and Monsieur Ronald fucking McDonald, Gary Pervier didn't give a shit for any of them. A broad, tawny shape was moving through the high grass to his left, and a moment later, Cujo, on one of his rambles, emerged into Gary's tattered front yard. He saw Gary and barked once, politely. Then he came over, wagging his tail.
"Cujo, you old son of a whore," Gary said.
He put his screwdriver down and began digging methodically through his pockets for dog biscuits. He always kept a few on hand for Cujo, who was one of your old-fashioned, dyed-in-the-wool good dogs. He found a couple in his shirt pocket and held them up.
"Sit, boy. Sit up."
No matter how low or how mean he was feeling, the sight of that 200-pound dog sitting up like a rabbit never failed to tickle him. Cujo sat up, and Gary saw a short but ugly-looking scratch healing on the dog's muzzle. Gary tossed him the biscuits, which were shaped like bones, and Cujo snapped them effortlessly out of the air. He dropped one between his forepaws and began to gnaw the other one.
"Good dog," Gary said, reaching out to pat Cujo's head. "Good."
Cujo began to growl, deep in his throat. It was a rumbling, almost reflective sound. He looked up at Gary, and there was something cold and speculative in the dog's eyes that gave Gary a chill. He took his hand back to himself quickly. A dog as big as Cujo was nothing to get screwing around with, not unless you wanted to spend the rest of your life wiping your ass with a hook. "What's got into you, boy?" Gary asked. He had never heard Cujo growl, not in all the years the Cambers had had him. To tell the truth, he wouldn't have believed old Cujo had a growl in him. Cujo wagged his tail a little bit and came over to Gary to be patted, as if ashamed of his momentary lapse.
"Hey, that's more like it," Gary said, ruffling the big dog's fur.
It had been one scorcher of a week, and more coming, according to George Mira, who had heard it from Aunt Evie Chalmers. He supposed that was it. Dogs felt the heat even more than people did, and he guessed there was no rule against a mutt getting testy once in a while.
But it sure had been funny hearing Cujo growl like that.
If Joe Camber had told him, Gary wouldn't have believed it.
"Go get your other biscuit," Gary said, and pointed.
Cujo turned around, went to the biscuit, picked it up, mouthed it, a long string of saliva depending from his mouth, and then dropped it. He looked at Gary apologetically.
"You turning down chow?" Gary said unbelievingly. "You?"
Cujo picked up the dog biscuit again and ate it.
"That's better," Gary said. "A little heat ain't gonna kill ya. Ain't gonna kill me either, but it bitches the shit out of my hemorrhoids. Well, I don't give a shit if they get as big as fucking golf balls, you know it?"
He swatted a mosquito. Cujo lay down beside Gary's chair as Gary picked up his screwdriver again. It was almost time to go in and freshen it up, as the country club cunt said.
"Freshen up my ass," Gary said.
He gestured at the roof of his house, and a sticky mixture of orange juice and vodka trickled down his sunburned, scrawny arm.
"Look at that chimbley, Cujo guy. Falling right the fuck down. And you know what? I don't give a shit. The whole place could fall flat, and I wouldn't fat sideways to a dime, you know that?"
Cujo thumped his tail a little. He didn't know what this man was saying, but the rhythms were familiar and the patterns were soothing. These polemics had gone on a dozen times a week since, well, as far as Cujo was concerned, since forever. Cujo liked this man, who always had food. Just lately, Cujo didn't seem to want food. But if the man wanted him to eat, he would. Then he could lie here, as he was now, and listen to the soothing talk. All in all, Cujo didn't feel very well. He hadn't growled at the man because he was hot, but simply because he didn't feel good. For a moment there, just a moment, he had felt like biting the man.
"Got your nose in the brambles, looks like," Gary said. "What was you after? Woodchuck? Rabbit?"
Cujo thumped his tail a little. Crickets sang in the rampant bushes. Behind the house, honeysuckle grew in a wild drift, calling the somnolent bees of a summer afternoon. Everything in Cujo's life should have been right, but somehow it wasn't. He just didn't feel good at all.
"I don't even give a shit if all that Georgia redneck's teeth fall out, and all of Ray Gunn's teeth, too," Gary said, and stood up unsteadily.
The lawn chair fell over and collapsed itself. If you had guessed that Gary Pervier didn't give a shit, you would have been right.
"Excuse me, boy."
He went inside and built himself another screwdriver. The kitchen was a buzzing, fly-blown horror of split-open green garbage bags, empty cans, and empty liquor bottles. When Gary came back out again, fresh drink in hand, Cujo had left. On the last day of June, Donna Trenton came back from downtown Castle Rock. The locals called it Down Street, but at least she hadn't picked up that particular mainism yet, where she had dropped Tad off at his afternoon day camp and picked up a few groceries at the Agway Market. She was hot and tired, and the sight of Steve Kemp's battered Ford Econoline van with the gaudy desert murals painted on the sides suddenly turned her furious. Anger had simmered all day. Vic had told her about the impending trip at breakfast, and when she had protested being left alone with Tad for what might be 10 days or 2 weeks or God only knew, he made it clear to her exactly what the stakes were. He had thrown a scare into her, and she didn't like to be frightened. Up until this morning, she had treated the Red Raspberry Zingers affair as a joke, a rather good one at Vic and Roger's expense. She had never dreamed that such an absurd thing could have such serious consequences. Then Tad had been scratchy about going off to the day camp, complaining that a bigger boy had pushed him down last Friday. The bigger boy's name was Stanley Dobson, and Tad was afraid that Stanley Dobson might push him down again today. He had cried and clutched on to her when she got him to the American Legion field where the camp was held, and she'd had to pry his fingers loose from her blouse, finger by finger, making her feel more like a Nazi than a mom. "You will go to day camp, ja? Ja, mein Mama." Sometimes Tad seemed so young for his age, so vulnerable. Weren't only children supposed to be precocious and resourceful? His fingers had been chocolatey and had left fingerprints on her blouse. They reminded her of the blood-stained handprints you sometimes saw in cheap detective magazines. To add to the fun, her pinto had started to act funny on the way home from the market, jerking and hitching as if it had an automotive case of hiccups. It had smoothed out after a bit, but what could happen once could happen again, And just to put a little icing on the cake, here was Steve Kemp. "Well, no bullshit," she muttered, grabbed her bag of groceries, and got out, a pretty dark-haired woman of 29, tall, gray-eyed. She somehow managed to look tolerably fresh in spite of the relentless heat, her tad-printed blouse, and academy gray shorts that felt pasted to her hips and fanny. She went up the steps quickly and into the house by the porch door. Steve was sitting in Vic's living room chair. He was drinking one of Vic's beers. He was smoking a cigarette, presumably one of his own. The TV was on, and the agonies of General Hospital played out there in living color. "The princess arrives," Steve said with the lopsided grin she had once found so charming and interestingly dangerous. "I thought you were never going to—" "I want you out of here, you son of a bitch," she said tonelessly, and went through into the kitchen. She put the grocery bag down on the counter and started putting things away. She could not remember when she had last been so angry, so furious that her stomach had tied itself in a gripping, groaning knot. One of the endless arguments with her mother, maybe. One of the real horror shows before she had gone away to school. When Steve came up behind her and slipped his tanned arms around her bare midriff, she acted with no thought at all. She brought her elbow back into his lower chest. Her temper was not cooled by the obvious fact that he had anticipated her. He played a lot of tennis, and her elbow felt as if it had struck a stone wall coated with a layer of hard rubber. She turned around and looked into his grinning, bearded face. She stood 5'11" and was an inch taller than Vic when she wore heels, but Steve was nearly 6'5". "Didn't you hear me? I want you out of here!" "Now,
What for? He asked. The little one is off making beaded loincloths, or shooting apples off the head of counselors with his little bow and arrow, or whatever they do. And hubby is busting heavies at the office. And now is the time for Castle Rock's prettiest housefrau and Castle Rock's resident poet and tennis bum to make all the bells of sexual congress chime in lovely harmony.
I see you parked out in the driveway, Donna said. Why not just tape a big sign to the side of your van? I'm fucking Donna Trenton, or something witty like that.
I've got every reason to park in the driveway, Steve said, still grinning. I've got that dresser in the back, stripped clean. Even as I wish you were yourself, my dear.
You can put it on the porch. I'll take care of it. While you're doing that, I'll write you a check. His smile faded a little. For the first time since she had come in, the surface charm slipped a little, and she could see the real person underneath. It was a person she didn't like at all. A person that dismayed her when she thought of him in connection with herself. She had lied to Vic, gone behind his back in order to go to bed with Steve Kemp. She wished that what she felt now could be something as simple as rediscovering herself, as after a nasty bout of fever, or rediscovering herself as Vic's mate. But when you took the bark off it, the simple fact was that Steve Kemp, publishing poet, itinerant furniture stripper and refinisher, chair caner, fair amateur tennis player, excellent afternoon lover, was a turd.
Be serious, he said.
Yeah, no one could reject handsome, sensitive Stephen Kemp, she said. It's got to be a joke. Only it's not. So what you do, handsome, sensitive Stephen Kemp, is put the dresser on the porch, get your check, and blow.
Don't talk to me like that, Donna.
His hand moved to her breast and squeezed. It hurt. She began to feel a little scared as well as angry. But hadn't she been a little scared all along? Hadn't that been part of the nasty, scuzzy little thrill of it? She slapped his hand away.
Don't you get on my case, Donna.
He wasn't smiling now.
It's too goddamn hot.
Me, on your case. You were here when I came in. Being frightened of him had made her angrier than ever. He wore a heavy black beard that climbed high on his cheekbones, and it occurred to her suddenly that although she had seen his penis close up, had had it in her mouth, she had never really seen what his face looked like.
What do you mean? He said. Is that you had a little itch, and now it's scratched, so fuck off, right? Who gives a crap about how I feel?
You're breathing on me, she said, and pushed him away to take the milk to the refrigerator. He was not expecting it this time. Her shove caught him off balance, and he actually stumbled back a step. His forehead was suddenly divided by lines, and a dark flush flared high on his cheekbones. She had seen him look this way on the tennis courts behind the Bridgeton Academy building sometimes, when he blew an easy point. She had watched him play several times, including two sets during which he had mopped up her panting, puffing husband with ease, and on the few occasions she had seen him lose, his reaction had made her extremely uneasy about what she had gotten into with him. He had published poems in over 24 little magazines, and a book, Chasing Sundown, had been published by an outfit in Baton Rouge called The Press Over the Garage. He had graduated from Drew in New Jersey. He held strong opinions on modern art, the upcoming nuclear referendum question in Maine, the films of Andy Warhol, and he took a double fault the way Tad took the news it was bedtime. Now he came after her, grabbed her shoulder, and spun her around to face him. The carton of milk fell from her hand and split open on the floor.
"There, look at that," Donna said. "Nice going, hot shot."
"Listen, I'm not going to be pushed around. Do you?"
"You get out of here!" she screamed into his face.
Her spittle sprayed his cheeks and his forehead.
"What do I have to do to convince you? Do you need a picture? You're not welcome here. Go be God's gift to some other woman."
"You cheap, cock-teasing little bitch," he said.
His voice was sullen, his face ugly. He didn't let go of her arm.
"And take the bureau with you. Pitch it in the dump."
She pulled free of him and got the wash rag from its place hung over the sink faucet. Her hands were trembling, her stomach was upset, and she was starting to get a headache. She thought that soon she would vomit. She got down on her hands and knees and began wiping up the spilt milk.
"Yeah, you think you're something," he said. "When did your crotch turn to gold? You loved it. You screamed for more."
"You've got the right tense anyway, champ," she said, not looking up.
Her hair hung in her face, and she liked it that way just fine. She didn't want him to see how pale and sick her face was. She felt as if someone had pushed her into a nightmare. She felt that if she looked at herself in a mirror at this moment, she would see an ugly, capering witch.
"Get out, Steve. I'm not going to tell you again."
"And what if I don't? You're going to call Sheriff Bannerman?" "Sure. Just say, 'Hi there, George. This is Mr. Businessman's wife, and the guy I've been screwing on the side won't leave. Would you please come on up here and roust him?'" "That what you're going to say?"
The fright went deep now. Before marrying Vic, she had been a librarian in the Westchester school system, and her own private nightmare had always been telling the kids for the third time, in her loudest speaking voice, to quiet down at once, please. When she did that, they always had, enough for her to get through the period at least. But what if they wouldn't? That was her nightmare. What if they absolutely wouldn't? What did that leave? The question scared her. It scared her that such a question should ever have to be asked, even to oneself, in the dark of night. She had been afraid to use her loudest voice, and had done so only when it became absolutely necessary, because that was where civilization came to an abrupt, screeching halt. That was the place where the tar turned to dirt. If they wouldn't listen when you used your very loudest voice, a scream became your only recourse. This was the same sort of fear. The only answer to the man's question, of course, was that she would scream if he came near her. But would she? "Go," she said in a lower voice. "Please. It's over."
"What if I decide it isn't? What if I decide to just rape you there on the floor in that damned spilt milk?"
She looked up at him through the tangle of hair. Her face was still pale, and her eyes were too big, ringed with white flesh.
"Then you'll have a fight on your hands. And if I get a chance to tear your balls off or put one of your eyes out, I won't hesitate."
For just a moment before his face closed up, she thought he looked uncertain. He knew she was quick, in pretty good shape. He could beat her at tennis, but she made him sweat to do it. His balls and his eyes were probably safe, but she might very well put some furrows in his face. It was a question of how far he wanted to go. She smelled something thick and unpleasant in the air of her kitchen, some whiff of the jungle, and realized with dismay that it was a mixture of her fear and his rage. It was coming out of their pores.
"I'll take the bureau back to my shop," he said. "Why don't you send your handsome hubby down for it, Donna? He and I can have a nice talk about stripping."
He left then, pulling the door which communicated between the living room and the porch to behind him, almost hard enough to break the glass. A moment later the engine of his van roared, settled into a ragged idle, and then dropped to a working pitch as he threw it in gear. He screeched his tires as he left. Donna finished wiping the milk up slowly, rising from time to time to wring out her rag in the stainless steel sink. She watched the threads of milk run down the drain. She was trembling all over, partly from reaction, partly from relief. She had barely heard Steve's implied threat to tell Vic. She could only think over and over again about the chain of events that had led to such an ugly scene. She sincerely believed she had drifted into her affair with Steve Kemp almost inadvertently. It was like an explosion of sewage from a buried pipe. A similar sewer pipe, she believed, ran beneath the neatly tended lawns of almost every marriage in America. She hadn't wanted to come to Maine, and had been appalled when Vic had sprung the idea on her. In spite of vacations there, and the vacations themselves might have reinforced the idea, she had thought of the state as a woodsy wasteland, a place where the snow drifted 20 feet high in the winters and people were virtually cut off. The thought of taking their baby into such an environment terrified her. She had pictured, to herself and aloud to Vic, sudden snowstorms blowing up, stranding him in Portland and her in Castle Rock. She thought and spoke of Tad swallowing pills in such a situation, or burning himself on the stove, or God knew what. And maybe part of her resistance had been a stubborn refusal to give up the excitement and hurry of New York. Well, face it, the worst hadn't been any of those things. The worst had been a nagging conviction that AdWorks would fail, and they would have to go crawling back with their tails between their legs. That hadn't happened, because Vic and Roger had worked their butts off. But that had also meant that she was left with a growing-up child and too much time on her hands. She could count her life's close friends on the fingers of one hand. She was confident that the ones she made would be her friends forever, come hell or high water. But she had never made friends quickly or easily. She had toyed with the idea of getting her Maine certification. Maine and New York were reciprocal. It was mostly a matter of filling out some forms. Then she could go see the superintendent of schools and get her name put on the sub-list for Castle Rock High. It was a ridiculous notion, and she shelved it after running some figures on her pocket calculator. Gasoline and sitter's fees would eat up most of the $28 a day she might have made. "I've become the fabled great American housewife," she had thought dismally one day last winter, watching sleet spick and spack down against the porch storm windows. "Sitting home, feeding Tad his Franks and beans or his toasted cheese sandwiches and Campbell's soup for lunch. Getting my slice of life from Lisa on As the World Turns, and from Mike on The Young and the Restless. Every now and then we jive it up with a Wheel of Fortune session." She could go over and see Joni Welsh, who had a little girl about Tad's age, but Joni always made her uneasy. She was 3 years older than Donna and 10 pounds heavier. The extra 10 pounds did not seem to bother her. She said her husband liked her that way. Joni was contented with things as they were in Castle Rock. A little at a time, the shit had started to back up in the pipe.
She started to sharpshoot at Vic about little things, sublimating the big things because they were hard to define and even harder to articulate. Things like loss and fear and getting older. Things like being lonely and then getting terrified of being lonely. Things like hearing a song on the radio that you remembered from high school and bursting into tears for no reason. Feeling jealous of Vic because his life was a daily struggle to build something. He was a knight errant with a family crest embossed on his shield. And her life was back here, getting Tad through the day, jollying him when he was cranky, listening to his raps, fixing his meals and snacks. It was a life lived in the trenches. Too much of it was waiting and listening. And all along, she had thought that things would begin to smooth out when Tad was older. The discovery that it wasn't true brought on a kind of low-level horror. This past year, he had been out of the house 3 mornings a week at Jack and Jill Nursery School. This summer, it had been 5 afternoons a week at play camp. When he was gone, the house seemed shockingly empty. Doorways leaned and gaped with no Tad to fill them. The staircase yawned with no Tad halfway up, sitting there in his pajama bottoms before his nap, owlishly looking at one of his picture books. Doors were mouths, stairways throats. Empty rooms became traps. So she washed floors that didn't need to be washed. She watched the soaps. She thought about Steve Kemp, with whom she'd had a little flirtation since he had rolled into town the previous fall with Virginia license plates on his van and had set up a small stripping and refinishing business. She had caught herself sitting in front of the TV with no idea what was going on because she had been thinking about the way his deep tan contrasted with his tennis whites, or the way his ass pumped when he moved fast. And finally, she had done something. And today, she felt her stomach knot up, and she ran for the bathroom, her hands plastered to her mouth, her eyes wide and starry. She made it, barely, and tossed up everything. She looked at the mess she had made, and with a groan she did it again. When her stomach felt better, but her legs were all a-tremble again, something lost, something gained. She looked at herself in the bathroom mirror. Her face was thrown into hard and unflattering relief by the fluorescent bar. Her skin was too white, her eyes red-rimmed. Her hair was plastered to her skull in an unflattering helmet. She saw what she was going to look like when she was old. And the most terrifying thing of all was that right now, if Steve Kemp was here, she thought she would let him make love to her if he would only hold her and kiss her and say that she didn't have to be afraid, that time was a myth and death was a dream, that everything was okay. A sound came out of her, a screaming sob that could surely not have been born in her chest. It was the sound of a madwoman. She lowered her head and cried. Charity Camber sat on the double bed she shared with her husband Joe and looked down at something she held in her hands. She had just come back from the store, the same one Donna Trenton patronized. Now her hands and feet and cheeks felt numb and cold, as if she had been out with Joe on the snowmobile for too long. But tomorrow was the 1st of July. The snowmobile was put neatly away in the back shed with its tarp snugged down. It can't be. There's been some mistake. But there was no mistake. She had checked 6 times, and there was no mistake. After all, it has to happen to somebody, doesn't it? Yes, of course. To somebody. But to her? She could hear Joe pounding on something in his garage, a high belling sound that beat its way into the hot afternoon like a hammer shaping thin metal.
There was a pause, and then faintly,
"Shit!"
The hammer struck once more, and there was a longer pause. Then her husband hollered,
"Brett!"
She always cringed a little when he raised his voice that way and yelled for their boy. Brett loved his father very much, but Charity had never been sure just how Joe felt about his son. That was a dreadful thing to be thinking, but it was true. Once, about 2 years ago, she had had a horrible nightmare, one she didn't think she would ever forget. She dreamed that her husband drove a pitchfork directly into Brett's chest. The tines went right through him and poked out the back of Brett's T-shirt, holding it out the way tent poles hold a tent up in the air.
"Little sucker didn't come when I hollered him down," her dream husband said.
And she had awakened with a jerk beside her real husband, who had been sleeping the sleep of beer beside her in his boxer shorts. The moonlight had been falling through the window and onto the bed where she now sat, moonlight in a cold and uncaring flood of light. And she had understood just how afraid a person could be, how fear was a monster with yellow teeth set afoot by an angry god to eat the unwary and the unfit. Joe had used his hands on her a few times in the course of their marriage, and she had learned. She wasn't a genius, maybe, but her mother hadn't raised any fools. Now she did what Joe told her and rarely argued. She guessed Brett was that way, too. But she feared for the boy sometimes. She went to the window in time to see Brett run across the yard and into the barn. Cujo trailed at Brett's heels, looking hot and dispirited. Faintly,
"Hold this for me, Brett."
More faintly,
"Sure, Daddy."
The hammering started again, that merciless ice-pick sound, whing, whing, whing. She imagined Brett holding something against something, a cold chisel against a frozen bearing, maybe, or a square spike against a lock bolt. Her husband, a pell-mell jittering in the corner of his thin mouth, his T-shirt sleeves rolled up, swinging a 5-pound pony hammer. And if he was drunk, if his aim was a little off. In her mind, she could hear Brett's agonized howl as the hammer mashed his hand to a red splintered pulp, and she crossed her arms over her bosom against the vision. She looked at the thing in her hand again and wondered if there was a way she could use it. More than anything in the world, she wanted to go to Connecticut to see her sister Holly. It had been 6 years now, in the summer of 1974. She remembered well enough because it had been a bad summer for her, except for that one pleasant weekend. 74 had been the year Brett's night problems had begun. Restlessness, bad dreams, and more frequently, incidents of sleepwalking. It was also the year Joe began drinking heavily. Brett's uneasy nights and his somnambulism had eventually gone away. Joe's drinking had not. Brett had been 4 then. He was 10 now, and didn't even remember his Aunt Holly, who had been married for 6 years. She had a little boy named after her husband and a little girl. Charity had never seen either child, her own niece and nephew, except for the Kodachromes Holly occasionally sent in the mail. She had gotten scared of asking Joe. He was tired of hearing her talk about it, and if she asked him again, he might hit her. It had been almost 16 months since she'd last asked him if maybe they couldn't take a little vacation down Connecticut way. Not much of a one for traveling was Mrs. Camber's son, Joe. He liked it just fine in Castle Rock. Once a year, he and that old tosspot Gary Pervier and some of their cronies would go up north to Moosehead to shoot deer. Last November, he had wanted to take Brett. She had put her foot down, and it had stayed down, in spite of Joe's sullen mutterings and Brett's wounded eyes. She was not going to have the boy out with that bunch of men for 2 weeks, listening to a lot of vulgar talk and jokes about sex and seeing what animals men could turn into when they got to drinking nonstop over a period of days and weeks. All of them with loaded guns walking in the woods. Loaded guns, loaded men. Somebody always got hurt sooner or later, fluorescent orange hats and vests or not. It wasn't going to be Brett, not her son.
The hammer struck the steel steadily, rhythmically. It stopped. She relaxed a little. Then it started again. She supposed that sooner or later Brett would go with them, and that would be the end of him for her. He would join their club. And ever after she would be little more than a kitchen drudge that kept the clubhouse neat. Yes, that day would come, and she knew it, and she grieved for it. But at least she had been able to stave it off for another year. And this year, would she be able to keep him home with her this November? Maybe not. Either way, it would be better. Not all right, but at least better if she could take Brett down to Connecticut first. Take him down there and show him how Oh, say it, if only to yourself. How some decent people lived. If Joe would let them go alone. But there was no sense thinking of that. Joe could go places alone or with his friends, but she couldn't, not even with Brett in tow. That was one of their marriage's ground rules. Yet she couldn't help thinking about how much better it would be without him, sitting in Holly's kitchen swilling beer, looking Holly's gym up and down with those insolent brown eyes. It would be better without him being impatient to be gone until Holly and Jim were also impatient for them to be gone. She and Brett. Just the two of them. They could go on the bus. She thought, last November, he wanted to take Brett hunting with him. She thought, could a trade be worked out? Cold came to her, filling the hollows of her bones with spun glass. Would she actually agree to such a trade? He could take Brett to Moosehead with him in the fall, if Joe, in his turn, would agree to let them go to Stratford on the bus. There was money enough. Now there was. But money alone wouldn't do it. He'd take the money, and that would be the last she would see of it. Unless she played her cards just right. Just right. Her mind began to move faster. The pounding outside stopped. She saw Brett leave the barn trotting and was dimly grateful. Some premonitory part of her was convinced that if the boy ever came to serious harm, it would be in that dark place with the sawdust spread over the old grease on the plank floor. There was a way. There must be a way. If she was willing to gamble. In her fingers, she held a lottery ticket. She turned it over and over in her hand as she stood at the window, thinking. When Steve Kemp got back to his shop, he was in a kind of furious ecstasy. His shop was on the western outskirts of Castle Rock on Route 11. He had rented it from a farmer who had holdings in both Castle Rock and in neighboring Bridgeton. The farmer was not just a nerd, he was a super nerd. The shop was dominated by Steve's stripping vat, a corrugated iron pot that looked big enough to boil an entire congregation of missionaries at one time. Sitting around it like small satellites around a large planet was his work: bureaus, dressers, china cupboards, bookcases, tables. The air was aromatic with varnish, stripping compound, linseed oil.
He had a fresh change of clothes in a battered TWA flight bag. He had planned to change after making love to the fancy cunt. Now he hurled the bag across the shop. It bounced off the far wall and landed on top of a dresser. He walked across to it and batted it aside. He drop-kicked it as it came down, and it hit the ceiling before falling on its side like a dead woodchuck. Then he simply stood, breathing hard, inhaling the heavy smells, staring vacantly at three chairs he had promised to Kane by the end of the week. His thumbs were jammed into his belt. His fingers were curled into fists. His lower lip was pooched out. He looked like a kid sulking after a bawling out. "Cheap shit," he breathed, and went after the flight bag. He made as if to kick it again, then changed his mind and picked it up. He went through the shed and into the three-room house that adjoined the shop. If anything, it was hotter in the house. Crazy July heat. It got in your head. The kitchen was full of dirty dishes. Flies buzzed around a green plastic hefty bag filled with beefaroni and tuna fish cans. The living room was dominated by a big old Zenith black-and-white TV he had rescued from the Naples dump. A big spayed brindle cat, name of Bernie Carbo, slept on top of it like a dead thing. The bedroom was where he worked on his writing. The bed itself was a rollaway, not made, the sheets stiff with cum. No matter how much he was getting, and over the last 2 weeks that had been zero, he masturbated a great deal. Masturbation, he believed, was a sign of creativity. Across from the bed was his desk. A big old-fashioned Underwood sat on top of it. Manuscripts were stacked to both sides. More manuscripts, some in boxes, some secured with rubber bands, were piled up in one corner. He wrote a lot. And he moved around a lot, and his main luggage was his work, mostly poems, a few stories, a surreal play in which the character spoke a grand total of 9 words, and a novel he had attacked badly from 6 different angles. It had been 5 years since he had lived in one place long enough to get completely unpacked. Last December, while shaving one day, he had discovered the first threads of gray in his beard. The discovery had thrown him into a savage depression, and he had stayed depressed for weeks. He hadn't touched a razor between then and now, as if it was the act of shaving that had somehow caused the gray to show up. He was 38. He refused to entertain the thought of being that old. But sometimes it crept up on his blind side and surprised him. To be that old, less than 700 days shy of 40, terrified him. He had really believed that 40 was for other people. "That bitch," he thought over and over again, "that bitch." He had left dozens of women since he had first gotten laid by a vague, pretty, softly helpless French substitute when he was a high school junior. But he himself had only been dropped 2 or 3 times. He was good at seeing the drop coming and opting out of the relationship first. It was a protective device, like bombing the Queen of Spades on someone else in a game of hearts. You had to do it while you could still cover the bitch, or you got screwed. You covered yourself. That way, you didn't think about your age. He had known Donna was cooling it, but she had struck him as a woman who could be manipulated with no great difficulty, at least for a while, by a combination of psychological and sexual factors. By fear, if you wanted to be crude. That it hadn't worked that way left him feeling hurt and furious, as if he had been whipped raw. He got out of his clothes, tossed his wallet and change onto his desk, went into the bathroom, showered. When he came out, he felt a little better. He dressed again, pulling jeans and a faded chambray shirt from the flight bag. He picked his change up, put it in a front pocket, and paused, looking speculatively at his Lord Buxton. Some of the business cards had fallen out. They were always doing that, because there were so many of them. Steve Kemp had a pack rat sort of wallet. One of the items he almost always picked up and tucked away were business cards. They made nice bookmarks, and the space on the blank flip side was just right for jotting an address, simple directions, or a phone number. He would sometimes take two or three if he happened to be in a plumbing shop or if an insurance salesman stopped by. Steve would unfailingly ask the 9-to-5er for his card with a big, shit-eating grin. When he and Donna were going at it hot and heavy, he had happened to notice one of her husband's business cards lying on top of the TV. Donna had been taking a shower or something. He had taken the business card. No big reason, just the pack rat thing. Now he opened his wallet and thumbed through the cards, cards from prudential agents in Virginia, realtors in Colorado, a dozen businesses in between. For a moment he thought he had lost Handsome Hubby's card, but it had just slipped down between a couple of dollar bills. He fished it out and looked at it. White card, blue lettering done in modish lower case. Mr. Businessman Triumphant. Quiet, but impressive. Nothing flashy. Roger Breakstone, AdWorks, Victor Trenton. 1633 Congress Street, Telex AdWorks, Portland, Maine, 04001. Telephone 207-799-8600. Steve pulled a sheet of paper from a ream of cheap Mimeo stuff and cleared a place in front of him. He looked briefly at his typewriter. No, each machine's typescript was as individual as a fingerprint. It was his crooked lowercase a that hung the